Hello, Jen, and welcome. I'm very, very excited and honored to have you as my first ever interview candidate. How are you today?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be your first ever interview candidate.
It's a funny thing. So, ever since you interviewed me, I thought, oh, I should return the favor. So it's nice to be on the other side of the interview seat. So I'd love to do a quick warm welcome to you and introduce you. So, Jen, you're the chief coach and owner of Sparta Chicks. You run this amazing radio podcast, which I'm keen to hear all about in a moment. I also understand that you're a former corporate lawyer. You became an endurance sports coach. You're also an author, speaker, trainer. You're an expert on so many things that resonate so strong with me. So you're one of my heroes. So you deal with imposter syndrome, feeding self-doubt, and I know that you've featured in so many different, like, triathlon, fitness, running magazines, anything to do with sports and related, I think you featured in that magazine, a long list of credibilities. So welcome.
Well, thank you. And that is spread over the last close to 10 years now. So it's been a long journey to get to this point at least.
Well, talking about your journey, it does seem like it's been quite a journey to go from being a corporate lawyer to suddenly being this coach extraordinaire. Can you give us a little bit of a snapshot on what that journey's been? How did you go from being a lawyer to the amazing role now?
It's actually hard to explain. I wish it was as simple as just to say a sliding doors moment. That's not quite accurate.
Do you want to
It
draw
was
a
a couple of
picture?
factors that kind of coincided in a perfect storm, I guess. I had been a lawyer for, by the time I left, it was 12 or 13 years, but around the 10-year mark, I think I got itchy feet, and I was feeling increasing dissatisfaction with life as a lawyer, especially in a private law practice. I loved the law. I still love the law. I still watch anything related to the law. I loved the work I was doing. I loved the clients, but I was growing dissatisfied, let's say, with the way that private practice were managed, was managed in that day. It has changed to some extent now, which I'm very glad to hear. So there was this growing dissatisfaction with life as a lawyer, which I had wanted to be since I was, I don't know, 14 or 15. Then while I was a lawyer, I had started, first I started in the gym actually doing strength training.
Oh,
And
great.
then, so that was actually my very first love. And then, truth be told, I started running to lose a bit more weight,
I
which
can
you kind of,
resonate and relate to that.
we've talked about that before.
Have.
But I was having a lot of injuries. I was injured all the freaking time. And it was only when I started working with a physio who was also a trained Pilates instructor that the pieces started coming together for me. I could understand where I had been going wrong in my training. I could see how all my friends and acquaintances were going wrong in their training. And so it was this sort of crossing of two paths, this increasing dissatisfaction with law on one hand, and then this increasing interest slash obsession with performance on the other. And then in 2007, I went to Nepal for a month.
Oh, wow.
And just my annual holiday,
Stamping
which
your
was,
passport?
yes, my dear passport. I missed my passport. And I remember being in Nepal and just thinking, I can't go back to law. I don't, I just can't. I am done. I don't know if I was burnt out as such, but I was perhaps mentally burnt out with the lifestyle and the expectations and the pressure. And so I kind of thought, well, I've got to come up with a plan to get out of here. And so the transition from one to the other, I wish I could have walked back from Nepal and walked in the door and said, I quit. But obviously, my more rational, logical, smart side said, you should go back to law for a little while, save up some money, and put a transition plan in place. So the transition took about 18 months. In the end, I first studied personal training, by distance while still working full-time as a lawyer. I started personal training on the side, you know, after hours and on the weekends, and sort of built the business up to where I could sustain a part-time legal role. And I was lucky enough that I was able to switch to part-time in law. And then eventually in July 2011, so last month it's 10 years, I bit the bullet and I walked out of a legal office for the last time.
Well done. That is an amazing story, and one that resonates with me also. Like, I know that you talked about starting to build the practice, you know, part-time outside normal working hours while you're working, and that's something, certainly something I've experienced as well. It's hard to get that balance right between working a full-time job and slowly morphing into a new career. So congratulations for doing that so successfully. And in 18 months is a short transition plan.
Well, that is just the time it took me from the point I had made a decision about what I was going to do. There was probably 18 months before that of thinking and tossing and deciding and weighing things up and like working things out. I explored archaeology there at a point as well in this process, this transition process. So it wasn't clear cut that I would end up down this path, but here I am.
Hey. And I know that you really work with women, like female leaders, to help them beat all that yucky self-doubt and the imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
And that. What's your biggest why for doing what you do?
Oh, that's a great question. I can see so much potential in people. If I had to say I have a superpower, I think it's actually the ability to see potential in people. And I am surrounded by smart, talented, you know, wickedly smart, hysterically funny, brilliant women in particular, brilliant blokes too, but the women in particular who cannot see that in themselves. Like, they just can't appreciate how bloody good they are.
That's a lot of you in them then.
And I just want them to see what the rest of us can see in them. I think that's it. I think that's my thing.
Do you have any favourite light bulb moments that when you're working with a leader that you just love, that, you know, kind of get you out of bed every morning?
There's always a few. There's this moment, especially if I'm working with someone in an athletic capacity, there's the moment when you can see the switch flick in their head, and they develop this, I call it quiet confidence. It's this very grounded, humble confidence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite a visual person, so to me I actually see it as though their spine has been replaced with a steel rod.
Oh, that's amazing imagery to imagine.
Yeah, that is the best way I can describe it. It's this resolve or determination and grounded confidence that they're ready, that not just ready in an athletic sense, but ready in the sense that it doesn't matter what happens on race day. They'll figure it out. Like, it doesn't matter what happens or what goes wrong. Mm. Nothing will rock their boat. They'll figure it out. And even if the race doesn't unfold the way that they want, they know they'll be okay. That to me is confidence. It's the confidence to me is the willingness to try and the knowing that you will be okay no matter what happens. And that moment when I see that spark in someone is just like, it just lights me up. That gets me out of bed in the morning when I see that.
Beautiful. Yes, I can imagine that. And I guess thinking from my own experience and from working with my clients, but also what you're saying, is that something that ties a lot of us together is this fear of failure. We're afraid of making a mistake, not succeeding, the embarrassment, the shame, letting people down, all of that. But you'll know yourself from working with your clients that it's from moments of failure that we actually have our biggest wins, our most uplifting moments where we really learn and discover ourselves. Do you have a favorite failure that's helped you get to where you are today?
How
that you feel comfortable sharing?
Oh, God, how many have you got? How many? Law was actually a failure in some respects because I didn't get the marks that I needed to at high school to study law straight away. Mm. So I had to go in the back door, essentially, to law. So that was a big disappointment at the time, but I also had the backup plan of working out how to get where I wanted to go. There have been any number of races that we could list as an air quote failure. Both, don't like the word failure. I think things are only a failure if you don't learn from them.
I agree.
And I have no doubt, don't get me wrong, I have no doubt there are lots of things that I have not, there are lots of lessons I have not learned in life that I still continue to try and learn. There's always something that doesn't turn out the way you want. Mm. Always. Like it could be as small as a training session. It could be a program that I want to run in the business. It could be what's happening for a client and it's not unfolding the way I thought things would. There's always those sort of more small failures where you put your heart into something, even if it's just a training session or it's a work project, and they don't turn out the way you want, and it sucks. Let's be honest, it sucks, and I think you have to wallow in it, and you have to grieve it, and you have to just feel all the feels, and then you have to reflect on it and work out what the lessons were.
Nice. So. You've actually skipped my next question, which was going to be how do you get through these moments of suckiness? But it sounds like you have a little system in place. Wallow.
Honestly, and I think what I highlight wallow because I actually think it is in this day and age of, I was going to say positive psychology, and I don't mean that specifically in terms of the field of positive psychology. I mean that in this, we do exist in a culture which seems to, in many ways, celebrate or encourage success, you know, only focusing on the good, only focusing on the wins, you know, what can you do? A very positive minded culture that I think wallowing is discouraged, but I actually think it's part of the process. I think it's one of the most important steps in the process. It's just recognizing that you're human and that you're disappointed, and that is okay. There is nothing wrong with that. And I think it's when we don't allow ourselves to feel it is when we are more likely to then, as Brené Brown would say, hustle for our self-worth. Mm. So we ramp up the activity, we ramp up the work to try and prove that we're better, good enough, that we're not the failure. And I think just, you know, giving yourself time to recognize that you are hurting a bit is a critical part of that recovery process.
That reminds me a lot of that. I've probably watched far too many children's movies, but it reminds me a lot of that great animated movie Inside Out, where you've got these characters that take on different moods or emotions, and the main character's feeling a little bit down, and they actually encourage the main character to actually have those feelings of sadness, that they are, you know, worthy as feeling happy or joy.
Yeah, I think I haven't seen the movie, and you're about fantastic. The third person to mention it in the last month, so I know I need to add it to my list.
I wish we could watch it together.
That would be fun. I do think we are, I think as a culture we're discouraged from feeling bad, we're discouraged from feeling sad. We don't talk, you know, traditionally we haven't talked about those sorts of emotions. We haven't been raised to be vulnerable, and, you know, admitting that you're hurting or sharing that you're hurting and that you're disappointed, you know, that's just being vulnerable. That's just vulnerability. And it's a healthy, essential part of the human experience, I think, is, yeah.
Yeah. And have you read the book Mindset, where they talk about the two different mindsets, fixed and growth? Again, what you're talking about, really kind of that feeling of I must always be successful, reminds me very much of the fixed mindset. Therefore, with the growth mindset, actually seeing failures or lessons, or when things don't go according to plan, is a really strong, healthy reaction, so you can continue to grow and develop.
Yeah. And it's, it's funny. It's not to say that, I think one of the things we often do too is get too, I was going to say get too attached with the lesson, but it's like we almost jump to what is the lesson in the situation. And going back to what I was saying about wallowing, like you almost need the wallow before you need the lesson and the reflection. And sometimes I think, especially family members, especially if they're a bit of like they themselves have problem-solving tendencies, our friends and our loved ones who are the problem solvers are quick to go, okay, what was the lesson? What did you learn? What are you going to do differently? What's the plan? Let's go, let's go, let's go. And I think, yeah, making sure that you have time to sort of wallow and process, rather than immediately jump into, okay, what's the lesson? What do I need to do? What do, you know, that's all. It's as important as that self-reflection piece around the lessons.
Absolutely. So I know that we have quite a bit in common, that we like to really help people to be the very best versions of themselves that they can be, to really be on top of their game. How do you define being on top of your game?
Oh, that is a great question. I think of it as having the physical, mental, and emotional energy and capacity to bring the best of who you are to what you do.
Nice.
And
That's a
I
really great
don't,
definition.
and I really, I don't mean, to what you do in terms of your just your work or your sport. I mean, in terms of all aspects of life, how you show up for your friends, how you show up for your family, if your physical, mental, or emotional health or capacity is compromised in any way, then your ability to bring all of you and all of the great parts of you and all of the not so great parts of you into everything you do is compromised too.
And we think of life as like a flower, and every single petal on the flower is one aspect of your life. And you really want all of those petals to be just flourishing. And often they're,
That's a
they're
great.
interconnected, they're all woven together.
Yeah, that's a great way. That's a great analogy. I like that one.
Oh, thank you. So then what do you see are the biggest barriers that are preventing people from feeling on top of their game?
Oh,
And I'm asking the big questions.
that's a massive question. If I had to pick three things, and I'm picking these off the top of my head as I contemplate your question, I would say, mindset is one of them, there's no doubt. A big part of that is a big part of mindset, and I think it's the part that's underestimated, is not what we bring to a situation, but it's the defensive mechanisms that we have in place, the armor that we use, to use Brené Brown's word.
Yes.
How we stop ourselves from showing up as the best we can be,
So how we react to different
how we
situations.
react, the expectations that we have, things like the stories that we tell ourselves, whether we are, overwhelm is the perfect example, and I think one of the place it starts is in our mind, because we've follow the expectations that we, sorry, we pursue the expectations that we set for ourselves. We expect things of other people, or we do what we think they expect of us. That sense of overwhelm is massive. Hustling for our self-worth. So whether that is, as Brené Brown talks about, whether that is perfectionism, procrastination, all of those ways that we kind of try and prove to the world that we're good enough. That's definitely one of the biggest barriers. Energy and well-being is definitely another. As I said before, I don't think you can show up as your best self.
So mindset you don't, first and then energy and well-being.
Yes, so energy and well-being is the second. You know, you can't you just can't perform in any aspect of life if your energy and well-being is not up to scratch, if you're not looking after yourself, if you're not, you know, getting the fundamentals of, you know, sleep. Sleep's the biggest one. Sleep, if I just, you know, sleep, movement, nutrition, hydration type things.
I was going to ask how you define well-being, because, again, it can be quite a curly definition that's often used and can easily be misunderstood.
That's a good question. I have not actually yet settled on a definition of well-being I am happy with. This is the problem with being a lawyer, is that I think the problem with being a trained lawyer is that your brain works in mysterious ways, and words, I think you recognize that words have meaning and language has power, and that words are very nuanced. And so every time I think I've settled on a definition of well-being, I go, actually, no, that's not quite it yet.
That's okay. We won't hold you to your definition.
Yeah, today. Don't hold me to my definition of well-being. I would say it comes back to that physical, mental and emotional health and capacity. Because I think when we're short of capacity, that's another telling sign.
Mm-hmm.
So mindset, energy, and well-being. And the third would be, oh, gosh, there's so many things I could choose. I'm going to take a skip. I'm going to come back to you on that
Various. So you've come up some great ones there. And I love how you said that as a lawyer, your brain works in mysterious ways. I thought as humans,
well, it does work in mysterious ways, let's face it. You know, most of my work is around the mysterious ways of the working of the human brain. But I do think it all starts with, you know, the barriers often start with mindset.
And that's in sport and business and life and all.
Every aspect of life. It truly is every aspect of life. You know, even what we think other people expect of us has a massive capacity for frustration, overwhelm, disappointment, you know, overworking, overcommitting, hustling. If I had to pick one, like, mindset is definitely the number one thing, I think.
Cool. So when we think about being on top of our game, it's kind of a little bit like being in a happy and healthy place. Where is your happy and healthy place, Jen? How would you describe that?
Oh, that's a good question. I am happy. I'm happy and healthy if I'm moving every day.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm moving every day, all of the other pieces fall in place.
Okay.
So my nutrition is better. My hydration is better. I make sure that I get to bed early because I know I have to be up in the morning. So some form of movement every day. In a perfect world, that would be with dirt underneath my feet and a big sky above my head.
Oh, that sounds beautiful.
So out in a trail somewhere is the happiest of places for me. At the moment, we are in very severe lockdown, so the options to do
my
that
heart goes out to you.
Are very, thank you. Are very slim, but we do have one little tract of dirt that I am on regularly. Or submerged in water. So I started ocean swimming a couple of years ago now. And it's funny. I started triathlons probably 14 years ago now. And I never really fell in love with swimming at that stage, but I always was curious about ocean swimming. It was just one of those little voices in my head that was like, one day. And so I started ocean swimming at four summers ago now, and I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with swimming. And so either of those two options are my happy places.
That sounds great. I'm all about the power of small habits, how the little things we do every day makes us who we are. And often there's a kind of a keystone, a cornerstone habit that really kind of means everything comes off from there. For you, it sounds like it's really about the movement.
Yeah, it is absolutely a movement. If I'm not moving, all of the other pieces slide. Mm. So I will snack on things that are suboptimal, shall we say. I will stay up a bit later, binge watching on Netflix. It's definitely movement. And I use that term deliberately. It's not necessarily about training. Mm. It might just be 10 minutes of yoga first thing in the morning. But if I move first thing in the morning, the rest of the day unfolds. All the other pieces fall into place that day.
Mm. No, that makes complete sense. So there's so many different thoughts and theories and myths out there about performance and well-being. What do you see for the people that you deal with? Is there a common myth that keeps on emerging when you talk to people about being the best versions of themselves that they can be that stands in their way?
Oh, God, yes. There's lots of myths, actually. One of the most common, I think, and I see this as much in sport as in everyday life, is the idea that more is better. Mm. You know, more work, more training, more hours, just more. And we know from an athletic perspective that it is not when you are exercising that you get fitter, stronger, faster. It's when you recover from the exercise that you do.
That's a hard lesson to learn too.
Yeah.
To fully embrace your body and live by.
Yeah, it's one thing to, it's a very good point. It's one thing to rationally know this. Mm. It's another thing to embody it and be happy in that place. So we know that from sport, like the scientific, physiological principle in sport. Much easier said than done, of course, for most athletes, whether you are, I see a lot of newer athletes really struggle with it because they've discovered this thing that they're really enjoying. Their motivation is pumped. They want to do all the races, do all the training sessions, buy all the kit, and, you know, they're really on fire. So getting them to understand that, rest is, I describe, exercise and rest, or stress and rest, as two pieces of the same jigsaw puzzle. They are equally important. So it can be a hard lesson for them to learn. And unfortunately, the one way it tends to actually get through to them is via injury, which is unfortunate.
Sounds like a new business owner as well, starting off really motivated, exactly. Trying to do everything. And
new business owner, starting in a new role, emerging leader who is stepping up into the ranks, someone making that transition from corporate into their own business. I see it everywhere, every aspect of life, even working. So I think that myth that more is better is the big killer, dare I say it, one of the biggest roadblocks for most people for achieving sustainable results and sustainable success. And I implore everyone just to remember that stress plus rest equals growth.
Indeed. I really like that formula. That's great.
I think it's so simple to remember. Hard to do. I'm not saying it's not
indeed,
hard.
It's one of those sounds simple, but really sounds simple. Easier said than done.
It is easier said than done. But I think the moment that you buy into it is when you do it, when you rest and you realize and you improve, and then you realize you can get better results on less work. And it's not until you, I think, test it out for yourself, really.
Several times.
That you get, several times, many times over years, speaking from experience, that you really get buy-in on the principle. But that's a lesson I would share with everyone, whether you're an athlete, whether you're in the corporate world, whether you're a business owner. Mm. Stress plus rest equals growth.
Fantastic.
So and there's a great book on that topic. Have you read it?
Of which one's
there's
that?
A book called, she says, I swiddling love, around in her I chair. Reading, so she
love learning about new books.
It is called Peak Performance. It is by Steve Magnus. He is a track running coach from the States, and Brad Stuhlberg, S-T-U-L-B-E-R-D. And they basically take this, so their background is, well, Steve's background is running, but they take this principle of stress plus rest equals growth and test it out and look at every area from business to arts to, you know, you name it, and yeah, explore how relevant and how widely applicable this principle is. So,
certainly, yeah. And that's one of the principles I have in my coaching practice as well, about the importance of balancing rest with recovery in order to really, you know, sustain that peak performance. I remember reading a fantastic Harvard Business Review article all about the making of corporate athletes. Yeah, and training corporate people, like sports people, really valuing the rest and recovery time.
No, this book explores that issue in detail in all aspects of life and all aspects of career. So highly recommend it for someone who is needing a little encouragement or has kind of hit the wall and realized that what they're doing is not working and that they cannot work anymore and something has to change. I'd recommend that book to anyone.
Cool. So less is more is the key thing there. And so while we're busting myths, I've noticed as a coach that coaches often misunderstood around what your role as a coach is versus clients' role, particularly when you have other similar disciplines like mentors, therapists, consultants, etc. How do you define what a coach does? Who is a coach? What's the value that you bring?
Oh, great questions. I think of a coach as someone who... It's a good question. I see it in two ways, and it depends on which part of my work you're talking about. I see a coach as someone who will hold the space for you, who you can authentically, safely share your goals, and they will sort of, you know, almost like a set of guardrails to keep you up, to keep you roughly on track. Just to keep you on track, to help with course corrections, and in many ways to almost hold a mirror up to you so that you can see yourself more clearly, because I don't think any of us really see ourselves particularly well clearly. So I see my role as a coach, my primary role as a coach is to ask questions. And to ask questions of people. Sometimes they're questions people don't want to answer, and that's okay. I'm okay with that. But it is to ask questions, to hold people accountable to what they say they're going to do, because we all need that. And just to create a safe space for people to chase their goals, because chasing your goals is pretty scary. And I think we all need someone in our corner when we're trying to do that.
And can I say, being on the receiving end of some of your questions as one of your interviewees, you are fantastic at asking questions. So it is quite novel, as I said, to have the tables turn and be the one asking the questions and having you answer them.
It is quite weird answering them for once. But, it's funny because I even think back to launching the podcast and talking about, people holding a mirror up to you.
About the podcast as well.
Talking about how people holding a mirror up to you to help you see things that you can't see in yourself. I talked about launching the podcast for 18 months before I actually did. And the thing that got me over the line was a friend who very kindly held a mirror up for me. And because I was saying to her, I don't have experience. I've never done this before. I've never interviewed people before. I don't know what I'm doing. Hello, imposter syndrome. And she just looked at me with this look of like, you idiot. And I mean that with all the love in the world. No, she didn't say that. That was my interpretation of her look. And she's like, how long were you a lawyer? And I was 12, 13 years. And she's like, she asked a question to the effect of, didn't you just ask questions all day as a lawyer? Isn't that a lawyer's job? Just to ask questions. Haven't you spent 10 years asking questions? And I just went, it was like this. I always want to slap my forehead and go, of course. Like, I have
one of those light bulb moments that you talked about at the start with the rod and the spine.
Yes, 10 minutes. Like, I just went, oh yeah, I have spent attending and asking people questions, maybe I can actually do this. So that's been an amazing example for me of a time someone held a mirror up to me so I could see myself in a different light. So yeah, sorry, I got distracted there.
No, that's okay. So we've mentioned already about how your cornerstone habits around movement and the importance of habits to really create who you are. Do you have a set morning routine that you'd like to share with everyone that really sets you up for the day?
I do. I probably have two core habits that really set me up well. So in terms of morning routine, it is out of bed, training clothes on within 15 minutes of my alarm going off.
And what time does your alarm go off?
6 o'clock at the moment. Thank you, COVID lockdown, because, you know, nowhere to go. I can't even go to the gym. So 6 o'clock at the moment, it goes off. Normally I am in clothes, ideally out the door within 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. I am not by nature self-disciplined. I don't think of myself as self-disciplined, but I have habits and routines that make me disciplined, because I know if I lay in bed, if I hit snooze, I am not getting up. So that's one of my rules, is like alarm goes off as my, like, I am pressing the alarm off as my feet hit the ground. So out for some form of morning movement. Mm-hmm. It could be yoga, but at the moment, especially given lockdown and restrictions and the fact that there will be no races probably this side of Christmas, this month I've set myself a challenge of 5,000 steps a day.
Wonderful.
Which is not much in the scheme of things, and I know it.
But during lockdown, I can imagine you
I just looked at my count for today and I'm only at, like, well, we can leave the house. So we're lucky enough to do that. So at the moment it's been heading out for a walk in the mornings. I haven't been running for a few months. So it is literally getting out and seeing sunrise. Half an hour minimum is my minimum. So somewhere to half hour to an hour. Back home for breakfast. And I think the one fundamental in this is that I do not touch my phone until I am making my breakfast.
That's great.
So I might listen to podcasts when I'm walking, but there's no checking of emails or social until breakfast. And I find if I do that, my day is set up well, because I find when I'm in bed, it's been an interesting experiment. The days that I do stay in bed, and I will admit this, I stay in bed and play with my phone, my brain doesn't work as well that day. Like, I feel more easily distracted during the day. I struggle to concentrate more. I'm more likely not to eat well. I'm more likely not to drink enough water. Like, it just fogs up my brain when I use my phone first thing in the morning, which is funny because I used to do it all the time and then I stopped for a period of time. And I don't think I noticed the difference once I stopped. It was when I then went back and started using my phone again in the morning, and I started to realize the mornings that I did, I was so much more easily distracted, struggled to concentrate, struggled to focus, just like the brain was flittering, really. So it's not so much the morning routine that sets me up well as such as the movement, let's be honest, sometimes that will be 10 minutes of yoga in my pajamas. So it's that, and not using my phone is the fundamental, is I think actually for me the most important piece of the puzzle.
Someone once talked to me about that same thing, about checking your phone while you're still lying in bed, particularly checking your emails. And the thing that stopped me from doing the habit, and in addition to now having a young puppy that I need to take out the back garden to poop and pee, this person once said to me, imagine like it's having those people in your bedroom looking down
at
your bed and your bed face and all of that. And now whenever I even think about checking my emails, I think, who are the people that are going to be in my bedroom? And I've just never been able to look at my phone in the bedroom since.
Yeah. I think it was, you know, I was experimenting with this because even reading with Peak Performance, you know, reading and starting to understand the impact that technology and phones have on our brain function, you know, the fact that they were designed on the same principles that poker machines are designed to get people addicted, phones are designed, you know, our social media apps are designed to get you addicted. So understanding all that. And then, but it was one day I hadn't been checking my phone in the morning. One day I checked it and I was in bed and I checked an email, and it was an email from, I had an email from a client cancelling their coaching. And it put me in such a bad mood all day.
I can imagine.
And I just thought, no, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not doing this anymore. You know, I'll deal with that when I've looked after myself first. So that was one of the make or breaks for me. So, and the other thing I am such a stickler for is looking at what I call looking after my future self. I use this phrase so often, my husband makes fun of me, but I don't care. So it's really about, you know, doing things today that will make life easier tomorrow. So, you know, like laying out all my training clothes in the morning, sorry, the night before.
Down sleeping in them, if you know it's gonna be really cold.
It's not quite that cold here, maybe in New Zealand. You know, even down to the headphone, you know, headphones, house keys, everything goes in one pile on my desk. Cleaning the coffee machine at night, so it's, you know, full of water and coffee grinder empty and all of that, you know, all of those sorts of things that just make tomorrow easier. That's another cornerstone habit of mine that I will continue because it just makes life easier.
I love that. That's really good. And I know that you're a real avid reader. You've already mentioned a couple of books like Peak Performance and also podcasts, particularly when you're out running or training or walking. Is there a book or a podcast or one of each that you wish that you'd come across when you were 16? That you would encourage, you know, 16-year-olds to listen to, read.
God. The book could be Untamed by Glennon Doyle.
I was hoping it was going to be one of your ones.
No. The book could be Untamed by Glennon Doyle. And the podcast. That's a tough one. It would probably be, you know what, I think it would be Brené Brown's Unlocking Us, because I think, so at 16 I was, I was going to say obnoxious, not obnoxious, I take that back entirely. You know, I was a highly motivated, committed, dedicated student. I knew I wanted to be a lawyer, like all roads led to law. But I was also very much driven by imposter. Now in hindsight, I didn't realize at the time, and very much driven by proving that I was good enough, if that makes sense. Like I chose law. I chose, one of the reasons I chose law, because it sounded like the hardest thing I could possibly do. So anything that would teach me or show me that I didn't need to hustle, I didn't need to prove, I didn't need to pick hard goals simply to prove how good I was, that would have been right up my alley at the time.
Yeah, that certainly resonates with me too. Mm. And what's Untamed about?
So, oh, no, I'm not going to tell you. You have to read it. I'm sorry, it doesn't help with your interview, but I would actually say, especially for women, read Untamed by Glennon Doyle.
I've added it to my list of books.
If I had to give it a 20 word snapshot, I would say it is about all the ways that women traditionally have been, I was going to say tamed, that's too easy to say, boxed in, taught to box ourselves in. Taught to shrink, take up less space, play small.
So sounds like a great book. Does sound good. Well, we've got final few minutes now before we wrap up. What's one question that you wish I'd asked you, and what would your answer have been?
I That's a you're good at this game.
Thank you.
I love that you said I love that you said thank you full stop there too. That's good. The question would be, God, I don't know. I would say, oh, you've really stumped me on this one.
Surely not. I cannot believe that could ever happen.
Well, I am stumped. I am often stumped. I probably just edit the stumpings out of my podcast so you don't hear them. that's a inside trick.
Writing notes here.
I would say, you've actually probably, that last question probably actually answered it. It's a question I ask every guest at the end of mine, which is around, you know, what did your 16-year-old self need to hear? And the extension to that question is, what would she say if she saw you now? So if that were to be my question.
That's now your question. How would you answer?
What would my 16-year-old, she would be, she'd be a bit dumbfounded, I think. She would have gone, how the hell did you end up there when we were going to be lawyers or we were going to be a lawyer? I think she'd be pretty pleased. I think she would, I think she'd be amazed. I think she'd be, the 16-year-old self would, the idea of being an endurance athlete, the idea of being an athlete to my 16-year-old self would have, like, dumbfounded. So the fact that I've done all the things I've done, I think would have amazed. I think she'd be pretty pleased with how we've gone so far.
I bet she'd be so proud.
Oh, thank you.
So lucky last question for you, Jen. If people want to find out more about you or to follow you or basically to, you know, track you down in the nicest possible way, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, I'm going to give you a few ways. So for Sparta Chicks, which is the online community and coaching business for women in endurance sports, you can find that at spartachicks.com and Sparta Chicks on all the socials. Sparta Chicks, yes. And for the rest of my work, so I work with smart people, as I call them, you know, results focused individuals, teams and organizations, helping them to create results that last and high performance that's sustainable. Mm-hmm. And busting the imposter syndrome along the way, you can find my you can find my website at SpartaGen. So that's SpartaGen.com.
Wonderful.
And I am Sparta Jen. That was only launched on Friday. So you.
I have to check that one out. I haven't seen that one yet.
You are the first person outside my. No, you are the first person outside my bubble. I have told that too. So what there an you honor. Go.
Honor today.
And Sparta Jen on all the socials as well. LinkedIn. You know, Instagram is where I'm happiest. You can find me everywhere.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time, Jen. It's been such a delight. You've been a lot of fun, as always. And really nice just to turn the tables and get to ask questions rather than answer them.
Well, you are incredible at asking questions. So I am very pleased to be the first. And I hope there's many more interviews in your future, Matt.
I hope so too. Well,
I think there should be. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay. And we'll wrap up there.